From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Barack Obama has earned one of the jewels in the crown in terms of endorsements for the Democratic nomination for president, that of former presidential hopeful and 2004 vice presidential candidate John Edwards. Here's Edwards from a rally last night in Michigan.
What all of us believe is in this America that we love so much, no matter who you are, no matter who your family is, and no matter what the color of your skin. None of those things will control your destiny, and that one America that I've talked about is not only possible, but it will be achieved under President Barack Obama starting in January of 2009.
That announcement came a day after Senator Hillary Clinton defeated Obama by a margin of 2-1 in West Virginia. Can Edwards help Obama snag white, southern, and rural voters? And does Obama consider Edwards a possible running mate if he gets the nomination? Joining me now is Democratic strategist Donna Brazile. She is the author of Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in America. Great to have you on, Donna.
It's great to be with you.
So Senator Edwards kept quiet on who he wanted since he dropped out of the White House race after losing in the South Carolina primary. Reports say he made the endorsement to help unify the party. So is that going to happen?
I think so. Look, we have three more weeks left in this presidential race, five primaries, 189 earned delegates. Senator Obama has captured the lead in both the superdelegates as well as the pledged delegates. John Edwards is someone who's very well respected, and already we've seen the benefits of this endorsement. The United Steelworkers Union, one of the most important unions in the Rust Belt of this country, decided to endorse Senator Barack Obama.
Now, a source close to the Clintons responded to the endorsement and told ABC News that, quote, clearly it's upsetting. He brings the workers to Obama. And that's very much what you just said. So in terms of this whole idea of whether or not Barack Obama can get white working class voters, does this change the equation?
No question. John Edwards has been able to not only reach out to white working class voters, but he's seen in the party as someone who can bring many Southerners to the table. He's a bridge builder. He has enormous credibility with organized labor, and I think this will not only help Senator Obama, but begin to help unify the Democratic Party.
So Edwards has 18 pledged delegates. Do you think he's going to release them to Obama?
Well, according to Rule 12J, I'm on the Rules Committee, a delegate is free to decide his or her preference, but clearly John Edwards will be able to pick up the phone and call all 19 of his delegates, his pledged delegates, and release them and urge them to support Senator Obama.
Now, in January, Edwards said publicly he didn't want a vice presidential spot or a cabinet position, but privately he reportedly told aides, yeah, he'd run for vice president again, or he'd want an attorney general position. So do you think Barack Obama actually is considering him for a VP spot?
I think it's premature right now to try to sort out many options that Senator Obama, if he becomes a nominee, he hasn't clinched the nomination, so I would like to be just a little careful before pronouncing him the nominee. But I think if Senator Obama is the nominee, he will have an embarrassment of riches in terms of the number of qualified people who could help not only serve in his administration but also serve on the ticket. But for now, Senator Obama should use Senator Edwards to help him in Kentucky and Oregon and the remaining five contests to unify the party and to reach out to those working-class voters that will be crucial to Senator Obama's victory in the fall.
Now, former Vice President Al Gore still hasn't said anything about who he wants, and you managed his campaign in 2000. So do you think he's going to make an endorsement?
I don't think that Vice President Al Gore will make an announcement before the end of the primary season. I assume that after the primary season ends, the Vice President will endorse someone and help unify the party.
Now, there's more big news from the Democrats. Yesterday, the Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean announced a joint fundraising agreement with the Clinton and Obama campaigns. It's called Democratic White House Victory Fund. So explain exactly how this works.
Well, what Chairman Dean is trying to do right now is to pull together the donors of both the Clinton campaign as well as the Obama campaign and others to begin to build a political war chest for the fall. The DNC will not only be responsible for helping to fund and set up the coordinated campaign. That is the campaign that involved not just the presidential candidate, but also the senatorial, the gubernatorial, and the congressional candidates, as well as down ballots. So what Dean is trying to do is to solicit the donors of both Senator Clinton and Senator Obama's campaigns to begin to help the DNC prepare for the fall election.
Is this really a chance to try to retire some of Senator Clinton's campaign debt if she ends up not getting the nomination?
These checks will be made payable to the Democratic National Committee for the combined campaign fund, not to one of the candidates. I think, look, when this race is over with, when the party unifies, I believe that everyone will reach down into their pockets and help Senator Clinton or Bill Richardson or Senator Edwards, anyone out there with a debt. But for now, we still have a very exciting race on our hand, and I'm looking forward to seeing what happens next Tuesday when the voters in two important states, Kentucky and Oregon, go to the polls. Well, I should say the voters in Oregon will have to mail in their ballots.
Right. Now, do you think that it's actually going to change the game? You talked about how this endorsement by Edwards is going to change the game, in your opinion, in terms of unions, et cetera. But is it going to change the game for the remaining contests that we have left?
I think Senator Edwards has the ability to not only reach out to organized labor, to bring some of the unions on board. You know, when he dropped out of the race, the Teamsters Union, SEIU, and many other unions endorsed Barack Obama. I think if Senator Edwards reach out to these unions, get them on board, it will be very helpful. His campaign manager, David Banya, a former member of Congress from Michigan, is helping Senator Obama in the state of Michigan. So this is a net plus for not just Senator Obama, but a net plus for the Democratic Party as we, enter the final weeks of the campaign.
And finally, superdelegates. You're like the person everybody wants to take to the prom because you haven't declared yet. But what about the other undeclared superdelegates? Do you think that this announcement could get some of them to speak their mind?
There's no question that the remaining 200 or so superdelegates who are undeclared will continue to come out publicly in support of one of the candidates. Look, I have made a pledge to remain neutral, not declare my support for either candidate until all of the contests are over. So sometime on after June 3rd, hopefully after June 3rd, I will make my position known. But I wanted to ensure that all 50 states and the six territories in the District of Columbia, those voters had an opportunity to cast their ballots before I make my choice public.
Well, Donna, it's always great to talk to you. Thanks.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Democratic strategist Donna Brazile is the author of Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics. Is it time to say goodbye to flavor country? A new bill in Congress would give the Food and Drug Administration the powers to oversee tobacco products. It would also ban most flavored cigarettes, including clove cigarettes. But menthol cigarettes would stay on the market. Some health experts say that plan could leave black Americans at risk, and the Department of Health and Human Services says menthols make up a quarter of the American cigarette market. But 75% of African American smokers use the product. For more, we have Bill Robinson, the executive director of the National African American Tobacco Prevention Network, and John McWhorter, a senior fellow in public policy at the Manhattan Institute, a libertarian think tank. Hi, folks.
Hi.
Hello there.
So before we begin, we called the major tobacco companies, R.J. Reynolds, Philip Morris, and Lorillard. None of them offered us a spokesperson to take part in this conversation. Bill, why don't you start off by telling us a little bit more about the legislation? Why do you think menthols were left off the list?
To be honest, I don't know. The legislation is what will, for the first time, give regulatory authority for a governmental agency for tobacco products, cigarettes in particular, but also it includes smokeless tobacco and various forms of nicotine delivery. Now, it's very interesting, over all of the years that the tobacco industry or the Federal Drug Administration has regulatory authority over all of the ways to quit using tobacco, but never over cigarettes and tobacco products that people actually use.
John, You've done some work on what you call black cultural traits, and menthols are really popular in the black community. Why do you think they're so prevalent?
Well, you know, I think that really some things are just a matter of chance. You know, and I don't mean that to be a boring answer, but I don't think that there's any, you know, gene that African-descended people have that makes them more like that particular menthol taste. It may just be a matter of a certain tendency that happens to have spread among a certain subgroup of people that might not really be due to anything in particular. There's certain foods that some groups like more than others for reasons that you can't really say. But I think that nevertheless, the fact is that there is an obvious popularity of menthol cigarettes among African Americans, and that needs to be taken into account when we evaluate this latest legislative proposal.
Now, we're going to go to a break in a second, but before we do, just quickly, do you think that this bill is a good idea overall?
Me? Yes, I very much do. I think that it doesn't go far enough, but, you know, life is never perfect and things almost never happen as quickly as we would like, and to the extent that it would help America in general, as well as black people, to get rid of a lot of these flavored cigarettes. And I think that that's a good thing, but to the extent that leaving out menthol highlights that something is going on that has a grievously disproportionate impact on the black community, I think what we see is a kind of opportunity for what some might call a civil rights initiative, but which I would call just sensible legislation to defend black people in this case, because obviously it's needed.
All right.
And I agree 100% in that this is a great starting point.
Well, Bill, we're going to actually have to take a break, and I'm going to come back to you after that. So Bill and John, stick around, and I want to say just ahead we're going to talk more about the tobacco issue, also about prison rape. It's a sad, harsh reality of life behind bars, and we're going to talk to advocates about what they're doing to curb the problem. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We are back, and we're talking about a bill in Congress that would ban most flavored cigarettes. Joining me are John McWhorter, a senior fellow in public policy at the Manhattan Institute, and Bill Robinson, the executive director of the National African American Tobacco Prevention Network. So let me jump right back into this, Bill. You know, your organization is against smoking, but you told the New York Times that you were in favor of the legislation, even though it still allowed menthol. So what was the calculus in your mind about this?
Well, for us, because we want a bill passed that regulates tobacco products. Now, we aren't exactly sure, and when the bill was initially presented to us, as to why menthol was left out, but we lodged our complaint about the being menthol, the missing additives, right away, and we're in further discussions understood that if we pressed the issue at that particular time, it may have put the bill in jeopardy, and we didn't want to do that because we think it's very important to make sure that this legislation is passed.
John, when you say that you support this bill, and yet you are, in broad terms, a libertarian, generally, you seem to come out against a lot of legislation that some people would consider more, you know, vice tax or legislation that really tells people how to live their lives. Why are you in favor of this?
Well, just for the record, Farai, I have never identified myself as a libertarian. I'm more of a centrist. I think I'm kind of hard to type. But in this case, what it comes down to is that this is legislation that will clearly have a disparate impact upon black people. I don't call it racism. I call it the rapaciousness of capitalism. Clearly, menthol makes these people too much money for them to consider getting rid of it. They're going to have to be nudged because there's a disparate impact. And it really is important, and I want to stress that we don't need to think about why it would be that black people would like menthol cigarettes more, nor should we question it. I mean, I'm afraid that some people are going to say that there's some sort of stereotyping going on. And this has been shown in surveys. I think anybody familiar with both the black and the white community knows that there's this difference. You know, people in China, not Chinese Americans, people in China don't like dogs as much as we do in America. Having pet dogs, breeding different kind of dogs, having a dog around the house, they don't do that as much as we do. Random cultural trait. God knows why it is. Groups differ. In this way, black people happen to like the menthol taste. And the fact is that if we don't do something about this, then a lot more black people will be dying than white ones. And I think that we can call attention to the fact that here is where capitalism alone cannot be allowed to rule because we have some deaths at stake. And I think that's a very viable case. We are human beings. We are a polity.
And I agree with
you. Please go ahead, Bill.
I agree with you, John. And one of the things that we want to make sure, Farrier, is that there was no compromise that went on in the negotiation of this legislation. when you ban menthol or when you exempt menthol, it puts our community at a serious disadvantage. When you, given the percentage of African Americans that smoke mentholated products, we want to make sure also through additional research that we understand the connection between menthol as an additive in tobacco project and how much it impacts initial use, addiction, difficulty in quitting, morbidity and mortality related to tobacco use. But that shouldn't supersede the right to ban this originally going in. And as we're watching this and beginning to study this a little more, we want to make sure that it's not some compromise that the industry facilitated to make this happen.
Bill, I want to move on to a topic for both you and John, which is money. You know, John mentioned capitalism, and a study by the Surgeon General in the late 90s said that major African-American magazines like Ebony and Jet got more money from cigarette ads than comparable magazines that didn't have a mostly black audience. There's also the issue of concert tours and festivals targeting black audiences sponsored by cigarette and tobacco companies. Do you have a problem with that?
Well, in a sense, we have a troubled history with the tobacco industry, but the tobacco industry was smart enough when we were, when the country during segregation, it said, look, we'll offer jobs, we'll offer sponsorships, we'll offer scholarships, we'll support cultural events, and down the road, that buys silence and it squashes opposition sometimes, and that's why we're in this fight. To help people understand that the exploitive nature of it, and the we shouldn't, even if you have those magazines, that the you can't put on a health page across from a health page an advertisement for a health, and then a tobacco advertising thing because sending a contradictory and conflicting message. So as we're trying to protect our communities, we want to make sure that our economic survival is not tied to the tobacco industry as it has been at some time.
It seems. Go ahead.
No, please. Same question.
It seems to me that this is very important because obviously cigarettes have receded to a great extent over the past 40 years from, for example, white middle class life. And there's clearly a calculus going on that we're going to see how many of them we can sell. Not only bring up China again in foreign countries like China, but also we're going to sell them to black people because there isn't as much agitation from them. And frankly, life isn't fair, and that's going to keep going until we make some noise. So instead of having long discussions about how terrible it is that Michael Richards uses the N-word in a comedy routine, we should be having more discussions about how we're going to get those cigarette ads out of our magazines, just as was done in the wider world of America a long time ago.
Bill, quickly, how do you see the evolution of regulation of tobacco? Do you foresee there's so many cities that are banning smoking in public places? Do you see that happening more on a state level? And what about on a federal level?
I think so, and this bill will help us get there. But one of the things that we're seeing is as we become more effective in this country, the tobacco industry is now moving overseas. So we see what was happening 40 years of the black community in this country now begin to happen in Africa. But I do see that cities across the country will continue to ban tobacco products. The Master Settlement Agreement, it's an unfortunate thing where we had this big settlement back in 1998 that paid all the states a lot of money, but we have not seen, what we've been seeing is through loopholes, the unraveling of these tobacco control efforts when many states didn't spend the money as was indicated and intended from the beginning, and we're losing in that sense. So the resources to fight tobacco are diminishing at a time when we're seeing an increase in smoke-free ordinances in cities and states across the country.
Well, Bill and John, I want to thank you both so much.
Thank you, Farah.
Thank you.
John McWhorter is a senior fellow in public policy at the Manhattan Institute, and Bill Robinson is the executive director of the nonprofit National African American Tobacco Prevention Network. Now we have a subject that's harsh and too often ignored. We are talking about rape in prison. Human Rights Watch estimates that 22% of male inmates in the U.S. have been raped at least once during their incarceration. The HIV rate in prisons is 4 times higher than it is in the general population. And in addition to rape, there's also consensual sex between inmates and sometimes consensual sex or rape between inmates and guards. Some groups say prisons should give out condoms, and others are fighting that suggestion. We continue our month-long look at the criminal justice system with a look inside the sexual health of prisoners. A warning to our listeners, this conversation may be graphic in nature and not suited for children. Joining me today are former prison inmate Keith de Blasio and, in a few minutes, Louisa Stanow, the executive director of Stop Prison Rape. She is going to join us in the conversation. Keith, how long were you incarcerated?
Well, I was incarcerated for almost 10 years between the federal and state system. In 1994, I was incarcerated on interstate trafficking of forged securities and credit card fraud with both the federal and state authorities. And basically, I was a white-collar criminal with no security risk and placed at an institution that was a what the federal government considers a camp. It had no fence, no towers. You were kind of on your honor to stay there. But during that time, I was sent to another institution with a little bit higher security level because of my being a little more apt to complain about things that weren't being done right by those who were caring for those who were incarcerated. And I was sexually assaulted at Milan, FCI Milan, Michigan.
Once you were assaulted, you began getting ill, is that right?
Correct. In my situation, it was actually somebody that they moved into the room with me after having been warned that I felt threatened. And they knew that he was HIV positive. At that point, I didn't know. I became ill, and just by chance, a friend of ours who I had seen as a physician as well was head of Walter Reed's infectious disease clinic at the time, and she convinced me that I may be seroconverting and that I needed to have another HIV test done, which kind of took a little bit of a pull from a couple of legislators, because I had just had one done and the Bureau of Prisons refused to do it again so soon. But at that point, I found out that as a result of the sexual assaults, I was HIV positive.
So when you say assaults, this was not one incident. This was many?
Yes. And what tends to occur a lot of times in the prison environment is individuals who use threats, coercion, to continue an assaultive relationship. In other words, it's not quite what we see on Oz, where there's a one-time, those situations occur, but more common is the person who is in fear of their life who continues to submit on a regular basis. And that's kind of, you know, what happened in my case is this individual demonstrated that he was the leader of the Vice Lords, one of the two major gangs at the institution, and that he had even connections with staff that would allow him to do whatever he wanted to do, and you just were not going to be safe.
I'm going to talk to you a little bit more, Keith, in a second, but I want to bring in Louisa. She is working on this issue from an institutional level. Tell us a little bit. You're the director of Stop Prisoner Rape. How did your organization come to work on this issue, which, frankly, a lot of people don't even want to talk about?
Well, Stop Prisoner Rape was started by a group of survivors, as we call the victims, and who had all survived sexual abuse in a jail or a prison and who came together to take action and try to improve policies and practices and put an end to this really widespread and neglected human rights crisis.
When you say neglected human rights crisis, what kind of issues are you really trying to combat?
We're trying to combat the the whole range of sexual abuse that occurs in all forms of detention. So we're talking about anything ranging from brutal gang rapes to sexual harassment. And it's all linked and all contribute to the very pervasive culture of abuse that occurs in almost all detention facilities.
So the issue of condoms in prison is one that is really controversial. What's the state of play?
Well, Stop Prisoner Rape believes that condom distribution in prison is a good idea. It's a public health issue, and it's also a human rights issue, that incarceration simply should not lead to serious illness and premature death, and we need to make sure that we help people keep safe and not have happen to them what happened to Keith. And we also know for a fact that the kind of ongoing abusive relationships that Keith highlighted, within those relationships, there is often room to negotiate condom use.
Keith, you were a victim or a survivor of assault. And did you also hear about consensual sex within the prison?
Oh, certainly. I think that there are many situations of consensual sex, as well as just, you know, what borders between coercion and just bartering, you know. There's a whole different environment inside a prison system where there are so many things denied you and so many power positions within, you know, structures, that sometimes, whether it is an actual physical force, a coercion by threat, or coercion by I need certain things to survive, or I need to feel protected, I need to feel comfortable, to then those who are completely consensual and those who may be, you know, prostituting within the institution to get cigarettes or whatever. So there's the whole gamut of people who are exposed to infectious disease that way.
Louisa, I want to talk about the Prison Rape Elimination Act. It was a federal law that was passed with bipartisan support in 2003. Has that changed things?
Absolutely. Stop Prisoner Rape worked very hard to help develop and advocate in favor of that law. And 4.5 years after its passage, we really do see a difference. It may not have trickled down yet to the actual facility level, but we certainly see a much more serious discussion among corrections administrators and lawmakers and policymakers that even 5 years ago, you would still hear wardens and prison managers claim that sexual abuse was not really a problem. And we don't hear that anymore. The question now is, how do we address the problem?
In fact, the Bureau of Prisons didn't offer us a spokesperson for the interview, but they did issue a statement that says, "The Bureau of Prisons is committed to minimizing the risk of sexual assault within federal prisons. We've increased the number of staff who directly supervise inmates," and you know, they talk about increasing technology and surveillance. Just quickly, Keith, do you see the effects of that commitment? Do you think it exists?
Oh, I do. And I have to say that in my situation, I think it was a very rare case of having prison authority so either oblivious or participating in allowing things to go on. That's not the typical situation. I think most of our prison staff, our prison guards, may become a little bit frustrated with their jobs and therefore, you know, not believe when inmates are telling them something, but most of them don't want it to happen. You know, it is a rare situation where you have someone who participates or allows something to go on purposely.
Well, Keith, you know, I have to say I want to thank you so much for sharing your story. And Louisa, thank you for joining us, both of you.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Keith DeBlasio is an HIV-positive prison rape survivor, and Louisa Stano is the executive director of Stop Prisoner Rape. Next, we have got sports with Tony Cox and New York Times sports columnist William C. Roden. Plus, we read from your letters. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. For 27 years, Reverend Doris Green has worked in Chicago to slow the spread of HIV. She's also in favor of HIV screening and condom distribution in the state's prisons. But she says that too often her concerns fall on deaf ears. A warning to our listeners, this conversation may be graphic in nature and not suited for children. Reverend Doris Green is the Director of Community Affairs for the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. Thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks so much. It's nice to be here.
So, Reverend Green, we just heard from a survivor of prison rape. And, you know, what do you see as the key obstacles to making condoms available in the U.S. prison system?
I work here at the AIDS Foundation in the policy department. And what we are seeing is we need more education here. And I'm sure this is happening in other states. Educating our legislators about HIV and also letting them know that, yes, there's sex going on in prisons. We have a hard time here in this state convincing our legislators that people are actually having sex in prison.
You know, you're a reverend, and you approach this this issue of HIV from a faith-based perspective. Some people say, you know, homosexuality is a sin. That may not be applicable to the cases of rape, but some people may feel, hey, consensual sex, they get what they deserve. I'm just saying things that other people are saying. Do you think there's prejudice in the way people are treating this issue?
Well, it could be, but my position, I'm a minister, true enough, but I think I'm a little different type of minister. Even working with the churches, I just think that churches and other people, we've demonized sex in such a way make people think that people can't have sex or not having sex, and it's a certain group of people, and it's not any of that to me. It's more of people being unprotected in this hour. I'm not concerned about who people sleep with. It's not my business. But what I am concerned about more than anything else is that condoms is available for people to be safe.
Let's talk about that availability. I understand that the state of Illinois has been resistant to your efforts. So what have your conversations been, or what's your approach to advocacy?
Well, my approach now, in our state, I have to admit that in IDOC here, we're working toward educating the people and not condemning even those that don't really understand. So I'd rather take that approach than to just say it would never happen. So we are working at doing different programs and trying to come up with a what we would call a demonstration project at maybe one of our jail sites to start some type of distribution in the prison, in the jail, on the jail level. So we're having conversations at the AIDS Foundation about things like that, about presenting these things to our legislators instead of just saying they would never, you know. Because I'm seeing change here in this state. I'm seeing information being put in prisons throughout the state for the families of incarcerated people. Never seen that before. There's legislation that has been passed. The African American Response Act was passed in 2005 here. And in that legislation, there's language about prevention in prison. So our state is beginning to do some more work around prevention and testing in prison and peer-to-peer education in prison. So I have to work with them now because it appears to me that they are getting on board on some levels. The condoms is something we're going to have to work on, and we don't have a problem here at AFC in educating our legislators around this subject.
This issue might be even more controversial when it comes to women because there are incidences of prisoner rape in women's prisons between prisoners and guards. There's also consensual sex between female prisoners and guards, and then there are consensual and non-consensual sex between women. Have you addressed the issue of women prisoners at all?
No, not at this point as far as condoms. No, we haven't, but I'm so looking forward to the conversation in our groups. We're beginning to meet here. When I say meet, I'm talking about bringing in community advocates from all over, different communities, bringing them together to start talking about when we present this legislation to our legislators, what are we going to have in it? I'm sure that we need to have some language in there for females as well, and I'm sure it'll be there. So, no, we haven't started it, but it will be part of the package because you're absolutely right. It's not just the male-to-male. It is you know, it is officers, and, you know, so we have to kind of make sure that that's in the agenda, in the plan.
What do you see, or what would you like to see ahead overall, not just for Illinois, but for the country?
I would like to see the religious, let's start with that group, that religious community to be, not to be so homophobia and stigma toward people that are HIV positive. I would like to see prevention throughout the states, all states. We don't have many prevention tools, but what we have should be for everyone, not just for people in the community or in the prison, because I don't separate the communities. The rate of people coming in and out of prisons in our state is so rapid, so you can't separate, at least I can't separate them. People in prison, people out, they're in and out and in and out. So I say people need protection, need to be able to have protection available for them if they choose to have sex. We can't stop people from having sex, it's obvious, but we can make tools available for everyone that need them.
Well, Reverend Green, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Reverend Doris Green is the Director of Community Affairs for the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. It's Thursday, and that means it's time for sports with Tony Cox. Hey, Tony, what's on tap this week?
Hey, Farai. You know, the University of Southern California is in hot water again over alleged illegal payments to a big-time college athlete. And no, it is not Reggie Bush this time. And here's a question. Why aren't there as many home runs being hit in Major League Baseball this season? Is it because the steroids are gone? With me today to discuss these and other issues from the world of sports is New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden, author of Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. Hey, Bill.
The great Tony Cox.
Hey,
Tony, how you doing?
I'm doing great, man. Listen, yeah. O.J. Mayo, before he left USC to turn pro with the NBA, did he receive illegal payments? Did the university know? Did his coach know? Well, that's what the NCAA wants to know and has opened a probe into the allegations that Mayo got thousands in cash and other illegal gifts from LA promoter Rodney Guillory. But O.J. denies it all and calls the accusations a, quote, publicity stunt. Here we go again, Bill, just like we did with the still ongoing probe into the former Heisman winner Reggie Bush, another Trojan.
The factory rolls on. You know,
the
cost of running a big program is very expensive. You know, I mean, first of all, it's interesting that the Ohio State High School Athletic Association has come out and said that no matter what the NCAA finds out, that Mayo's high school, North College Hill, is going to be able to keep the titles that they won from 2005 and 2006. So they're making a definitive statement. They say that no matter what happened, the school was not complicit. But, you know, here's the problem. Here's a larger problem I've got with this, Tony. And again, you know, it's this whole idea that the NBA and the NCAA worked on together about raising the age limit in order to get these kind of high school studs into their program. You know, okay, so chickens come home to roost. You know, you got Mayo at USC. You got Beasley and Rose. And although Beasley and Rose were not accused of anything, it's the same thing. You got these one-and-done things. You got these guys who should be in the NBA, who wanted to be in the NBA, who did not want to go to college. You're forcing them to go into college so that you can, you know, get a nice little payday for these top 20 schools that go to these schools. And here you have it. You know, you got.
So what should be done?
Well, first of all, if a guy wants to go to college, go to the NBA from high school, let him go. Okay, let him go. The NBA or the NFL, they're not going to take people who cannot work in their profession. You create this artificial environment, these artificial rules. And this is what you got. You got guys like Mayo at USC who don't want to be there, and they're going to take their professionalism with them.
And move on. I know you're not a big fan of the NCAA, but I want to ask you about another topic kind of related to what we're discussing. And it's graduation time, as you know. And the NCAA has released its academic progress rates, which show that in basketball, at least, the graduation rates are not so good. 53 Division I-A basketball programs are on that list for sanctions because they do not graduate enough of their athletes. And surprise, surprise, USC is on that list, along with other big-time programs like Tennessee. Now, here's the thing, Bill. Schools sanctioned could lose up to 10% of their scholarships. And by the way, the football list includes 17 Division I-A programs, but USC is not on that list.
Yeah, well, they take care of that, the football players. You know, it again, Tony, it's number one, okay, it's good. I'm glad that, you know, the NCAA has come up with a formula to force colleges to graduate athletes, but it should not have to be this hard. It should not have to be this difficult. And again, you know, I guess this is bash NCAA day, but again, you get into the semi-pro football, basketball on campus, you're recruiting kids who, had it not been for football, would not be going to these particular schools. You set up these study halls and all this kind of just so they'll get a degree. It's not working, Tony. The system, again, is not working. Unfortunately, we've backed ourselves into this corner where you've got these football factories who are recruiting kids who are only going there for the football or the basketball reputation.
Well, here's another system I want to ask you about to see whether it's working as we bring our weekly sports segment to a close. You remember Sosa, McGuire, and Bonds, don't you?
Of course.
And how they knocked the cover off the baseball all those years and how the fans loved the home runs but hated the steroid use. Well, be careful what you ask for because by some estimates, home runs are going to be down 1,000 this season from just two seasons ago. Talk about a power outage in less than a minute. What's going on here, Bill?
Well, seems to be people are cycling off. You know, you know, everybody's coming down. And
they really are getting B12 shots now.
That's right. The fans are saying, you know what? You know, be careful what you ask for. You may get it. Maybe it wasn't so bad before.
Kind of boring, I know.
Yeah.
Listen, really quickly, the Preakness coming up this weekend. Big Brown is the favorite. But horse racing is really under a spotlight because of what happened to Eight Bells at the Kentucky Derby.
Yeah, it's taking a beating. In fact, I'm on my way down to the Preakness. You know, Tony, and it's good. It's tragic what happened at the Kentucky Derby, but the industry is really being forced to look at itself in a way that it hasn't in a number of years, and that's going to be good because this is one industry that needs to look at itself.
All right, 10 seconds. Did you see LeBron's mama in the game four with the Cavs and the Celtics the other day?
Did you hear what he told her? Sit your – you talk about abuse.
Now, that's
abuse.
What I call a mother's love that you don't often see. Bill, it's always good to talk to you.
Tony, take care.
That was Tony Cox and New York Times sports columnist William C. Roden. Roden is also the author of Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Fry. How are you?
I am doing great. So what are folks saying this week?
Well, West Virginia held its Democratic presidential primary on Tuesday. That day, we spoke to two voters in the state about the issues they thought were driving the election. A few listeners thought we didn't give West Virginia a fair shake. Sandy Sorlene in Philadelphia sent us this. NPR can do better than this interview. As my candidate, Senator Obama, would say, it was divisive. On the eve of Senator Clinton's big win, the interview hammered the two West Virginia guests about the percentages of blacks in their areas, sketched some details of a horrid white-on-black crime, and asked whether this crime reflected West Virginia's attitude towards blacks. And then, when one of the guests actually started saying something thoughtful and nuanced, the interviewer cut him off abruptly, as if she were afraid he would say something good about West Virginians. NPR should be about supporting nuance and investigation, not cutting it off.
And Bernard DiGregorio of Charleston, West Virginia, chimed in about his state. I have been a resident of West Virginia for 18 years and have come to love the beauty of this state as well as its people. My life as a professional musician, educated, not all that rural and not all that poor. Why is it that on every news hour on your station you constantly paint the picture to the entire nation that we are rural, uneducated, poor white trash? Although trash hasn't been said, that is the painted perception by saying it over and over again. Bernard and Sandy, I want to thank you both so much for your letters. I agree from personal experience that West Virginia is a beautiful state, and we had no intention of prejudging your state. If you take a second listen, I think you'll find the guest had some complimentary things to say. As far as cutting off the guest, in this case we had some phone line problems we needed to resolve in order so that the guest could be heard more clearly. So I jumped in. It happens sometimes.
This Monday, on our Bloggers Roundtable, we talked about how the two Democratic presidential candidates were faring with white voters. That talk about demographics prompted one of our bloggers, Meiji Alabi, to weigh in.
My opinion, I think most of the people in this country are, the white people are Republicans. Well, a lot of listeners wrote in about that one, and they weren't pleased. Listener Terry McClelland in St. Louis, Missouri, wrote us this. I particularly did not appreciate the comment that all white people are Republican. It just seems sort of, oh, I don't know, a huge generalization. I'm a bit surprised that someone did not call him on that comment. Well, we did a little research and found that actually most whites vote Republican, but only by about 16%. According to the American National Election Studies, in 2004, 58% of whites voted for a Republican president and 42% voted for the Democrat.
We also got some praise this week from Laura Hudson in Dallas, Texas. Dear Farai and the News and Notes crew, I am a teacher who works in inner city Dallas. I work with minority youths, and I regularly listen to your show to gain more insight about issues affecting the black community and wider audiences. Also because many of the issues you talk about on the show touch other communities as well. I just wanted to take time to thank you and all of the various guests that you have on your show for coming on, speaking their mind, and helping give perspectives to the NPR audience. Thank you for all of your hard work and lovely intelligence.
And thank you for your letters, and please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.